Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we sift through mountains of information to unearth those truly impactful nuggets of knowledge, giving you that shortcut to being well-informed.
Glad to be diving in again.
Today, we're diving headfirst into a topic that's buzzing with innovation and potential, yet navigating some truly fascinating regulatory waters. Small modular reactors, or SMRs. Mm-hmm. You've probably heard the term, but what do these compact powerhouses really mean for our energy future? And how are global experts ensuring they're deployed safely rather than just, you know, rapidly?
Indeed. And this deep dive, it's built upon a series of pretty comprehensive reports from the SMR Regulators Forum, spanning from 2018 right up to 2021.
Okay, so recent authoritative stuff.
Exactly. Documents like their pilot project report and phase two summary report offer a candid, almost behind-the-scenes look at how international nuclear safety bodies are grappling with these novel technologies.
Grappling sounds about right.
It really is. So our mission today is to extract the core insights from these discussions, helping you understand the regulatory landscape, the inherent challenges, and the innovative solutions being proposed for SMRs.
Good.
We'll explore everything from how we define safe for a new kind of nuclear reactor to the very concept of an emergency zone. Okay, let's unpack that.
Let's do it. So SMRs are definitely a hot topic, promising a lot for our energy future. But before we get tangled in the regulatory web, let's nail down what they actually are.
Good place to start.
Are we just talking about smaller versions of big reactors, or is there more to the story?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Think of SMRs not just as mini nuclear plants, but as fundamentally reimagined ones.
Reimagined. Okay.
Yes. They are physically smaller, typically less than 300 megawatts electrical, or MWE, output, or 1,000 megawatts thermal MBLU per reactor module.
Right, so a noticeable size difference.
Definitely. But the real game changer isn't just size, it's their versatility and design philosophy. Unlike traditional large nuclear power plants, which are often built solely for massive grid-scale electricity generation.
Yeah, the huge ones we usually picture.
Exactly. SMRs are explicitly designed for a wider commercial use. This includes electricity, yes, but also things like desalination, turning salt water into fresh water for communities.
Oh, interesting application.
And generating process heat for industrial applications. This adaptability is one of their most compelling appeals.
That's a crucial distinction. It's not just smaller, it's also more adaptable, almost like a multi-tool for energy.
That's a good way to put it.
And I've heard the term modular thrown around a lot. So is it truly like assembling high-tech Lego for a power plant, or are we talking about something far more nuanced than that?
That's a great analogy, actually, and it gets to the heart of it. The modular design is a genuine game changer. It means individual components or even entire reactor units can be manufactured off-site in a factory setting. Think about the precision and quality control you get in a factory versus a sprawling construction site.
Right, standardized production.
Precisely. These prefabricated modules are then transported to the deployment site, where they're assembled. This often streamlines construction, reduces on-site complexity, and potentially accelerates deployment schedules compared to building a massive conventional plant from the ground up.
Faster build times, potentially lower costs up front, too?
That's the hope, yes. Plus, the modularity allows for the addition of multiple reactors in close proximity, utilizing shared infrastructure.
Ah, so you can scale up.
Exactly. You could start with one or two modules and scale up your energy output by adding more as demand grows, all in the same footprint. It's a completely different construction paradigm.
So it's not just about the size, but the way they're built and deployed that makes them different. And you mentioned novel designs. What kind of innovative technologies are we seeing in these SMRs that truly set them apart from their larger predecessors?
This is where SMRs truly push the boundaries, introducing some fascinating safety philosophies.
Like what?
For instance, many designs rely heavily on passive cooling mechanisms. Instead of needing active pumps or external power to cool the reactor during an emergency.
Which is a major safety system in current plants.
It is. SMRs often use fundamental physical principles like natural circulation and gravity-driven injection.
So physics does the work.
In essence, yes. This can dramatically reduce the need for operator intervention or external power in a crisis, making them inherently more resilient.
Okay, that sounds significant.
Another innovative feature is their integral design, where primary system components like the reactor core, steam generators, and primary coolant pumps are all housed within a single compact pressure vessel.
All in one pot, sort of.
Pretty much. This simplifies the design, reduces the number of pipes and welds, and thereby decreases the potential for leaks.
That sounds like a significant simplification of the plant's architecture. Fewer moving parts, fewer places for things to go wrong.
Precisely. We also see unique fuel designs, such as advanced ceramic materials like TRISO fuels, often used in high-temperature gas reactors, or even molten salt fuel in some designs. Unlike the metallic cladding of traditional fuels, TRISO fuels encapsulate tiny uranium particles in layers of robust ceramic materials.
How does that help?
It essentially means each microscopic fuel particle is its own tiny, super-strong containment vessel. It's designed to withstand extreme temperatures and contain fission products, even if the reactor core itself gets severely damaged.
Wow. Containment at the micro level.
Exactly. And this leads to some designs claiming the practical elimination of some severe accidents.
Practical elimination of severe accidents. That sounds almost too good to be true. A really bold claim.
It is a massive claim.
What kind of evidence do regulators demand to truly accept such a bold claim? How do you prove something like that?
Oh, it draws a lot of regulatory attention and scrutiny, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
For regulators, it means demanding rigorous, multifaceted proof, not just theoretical calculations.
Right, not just simulations.
No. Extensive R&D, experimental testing on prototypical systems, integrated test facilities, and validated computer models. All to substantiate that the design physically prevents or inherently mitigates these accident sequences to such an extent that their likelihood is genuinely negligible.
A very high bar, then.
Extremely high.
Fascinating. So what does this all mean for their potential role in our energy future? What kind of impact are we talking about here beyond just kilowatt hours?
Well, the real potential game changer here isn't just more electricity. It's arguably the democratization of nuclear power.
Democratization? How so?
SMRs could allow smaller nations or even remote communities within larger ones to achieve energy independence and security of supply in a way traditional reactors never allowed.
Because they're smaller and maybe easier to site?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Imagine smaller, more flexible power sources that can be deployed in areas with less robust grids or integrated directly with industrial complexes that need both electricity and process heat.
Right, that dual use capability.
Plus, they offer inherent benefits like increased core stability, meaning the reactor has a natural tendency to regulate itself, to stay in a safe, steady state, even if there are disturbances.
So, more forgiving.
It's less prone to sudden power spikes or runaway reactions, making it inherently more forgiving, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a smaller radionuclide inventory compared to large plants.
Less radioactive material overall.
Correct, which simply means there's a smaller total amount of radioactive material contained within the reactor, inherently reducing the potential consequences if there's ever an accidental release.
Okay, that paints a picture of immense promise. But with all this novelty and ambition, it's clear that regulators wouldn't just wave them through with existing rule books.
Absolutely not.
Why exactly are SMRs considered such a new challenge for regulators?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it stems from the very nature of their innovation. First, SMR development and deployment are still at a very early stage.
Still quite new, despite the buzz.
Right. While there's global interest, the technologies themselves are still maturing, and detailed design information from vendors is often considered proprietary or limited.
Ah, the proprietary info issue.
Which makes it difficult for regulators to conduct a full independent assessment sometimes. This lack of concrete, publicly available data creates significant regulatory uncertainty.
So regulators are being asked to evaluate something that's still evolving and with incomplete information. That's a tough spot.
It is.
How do they ensure safety when they're essentially flying blind on some proprietary details? Is there a workaround?
It's a huge hurdle. Regulators address this by requiring very specific, comprehensive safety cases from vendors. They often demand independent verification through testing and simulation. And they also rely on a process where, even if the full proprietary design isn't disclosed, the safety-relevant information is made available for regulatory scrutiny, sometimes under non-disclosure agreements.
Got it. So access to the crucial bits.
Yes. Compounding that is the challenge of novelty versus established frameworks. Mm-hmm. Existing regulatory frameworks, safety principles like defense in depth, and licensing processes were primarily developed for large conventional nuclear power plants.
Built for the giants.
Right. So SMRs, with their unique features, those passive systems, multi-module configurations, factory fueling, and even transportability, inherently challenge these traditional approaches.
Because the assumptions are different.
Exactly. Regulators are left asking fundamental questions about the applicability and interpretation of long-standing safety principles to these new designs.
I can see how a framework built for one type of technology would struggle to adapt to something so different. That regulatory dilemma sounds like an understatement.
It really is.
How do they actually balance embracing innovation with the absolute imperative of not compromising safety? That seems like the core tension.
That's the core of the dilemma, precisely. Regulators are being approached with safety proposals that seek to relax certain requirements based on these alleged inherent safety features.
Ours is safer, so we need fewer rules.
That's the essence of some arguments, yes. Oh. The forum explicitly states there's a need to develop a balanced framework, one that is adaptable for a wide range of these new technologies while still ensuring the highest safety outcomes.
Adaptable, but still rigorous.
Exactly. It's about finding that delicate equilibrium, constantly asking, how do we facilitate promising new technologies without inadvertently lowering the safety bar? It's a constant, active tension.
Finding that delicate equilibrium between innovation and rock-solid safety sounds like a tightrope walk.
It certainly can feel like one.
So how do regulators actually do that? What's the foundational tool they reach for when faced with these novel designs?
They turn to something called the graded approach. Imagine a tailor, not just a factory, churning out one-size-fits-all suits.
Okay, custom fitting the rule.
Pretty much. This approach lets regulators custom fit the oversight. It means applying regulatory requirements commensurate with the significance and complexity of a product or service.
Makes sense.
The potential impacts on health, safety, security, and the environment, and the consequences of failure.
So, risk-based.
Essentially, yes. A less complex system with lower potential consequences might get a lighter touch, while a highly complex or high-risk system would face intense scrutiny. This enhances regulatory efficiency by focusing resources on issues truly important to safety.
So it's about smart regulation, not just blanket rules. But how does this play out specifically for SMRs, especially when they're proposing such novel features and claims of inherent safety?
What's fascinating here is the nuance for SMRs. While the graded approach has been used since the industry's beginning, its interpretations can still vary.
Interpretation matters.
Immensely. For SMRs, designers often propose relaxing certain design and safety analysis requirements, claiming their inherent safety features naturally reduce risk.
Right, the it's safer, so relax the rules argument again.
Correct. However, the graded approach isn't a one-way street to lighter regulation. For novel technologies, or first-of-a-kind, or FOA grants,
right,
where uncertainties are greater and operating experience is lacking, it may actually necessitate more protective measures or additional regulatory effort.
Oh, interesting. So it can cut both ways.
Absolutely. It's about being proportionate to the actual risk and the available data, not just the claims.
That's a crucial point.
Yeah.
It can mean more or less regulation, depending on the specific circumstances.
Precisely.
And what about those truly unique SMR concepts, like factory-fueled transportable reactors, ones that might be built in one place and then shipped somewhere else? How does the graded approach handle something that doesn't neatly fit into existing categories?
That's a perfect example of a challenge. For factory-fueled transportable reactors, existing guidance might not fully apply.
Because it wasn't designed for mobile reactors.
Exactly. In such cases, the graded approach would require alternative methods that demonstrate equivalent safety outcomes to traditional approaches.
Equivalent safety. Key concept.
Very key.
Yeah.
It's not about ignoring safety, but proving that the new method achieves the same level of protection. To make these graded decisions, regulators use various tools. Results from robust R&D activities.
The data needs to be there.
Absolutely. Sophisticated safety analysis tools like hazard analysis, deterministic safety analysis, and probabilistic safety assessment, or PSA.
PSA. Oh.
And critically, they rely on the quality-assured use of professional judgment within a robust management system. It's not just ticking boxes.
So it's a dynamic, evidence-based process. Now let's move to another fundamental concept in nuclear safety, defense in depth.
Yes.
This has been the bedrock for traditional reactors, but how does it translate to SMRs with all their innovative features? Is this still relevant?
Defense in depth, or DEED, is recognized as the primary means of preventing and mitigating accidents in nuclear power plants, and the forum agrees it's fundamentally valid for SMRs. Still totally relevant.
Okay, so the core idea holds.
Yes. It's like an onion with layers of protection. Applying successive layers of provisions, organizational, behavioral, and design-related, so that if one layer fails, others compensate.
Redundancy and backups.
Exactly. Even though its principles were developed for large plants, DEED should remain a fundamental basis of SMR design and safety demonstration.
DD sounds like a complex safety manual, but at its heart, it's about layer after layer of what-if protection.
That's a good summary.
The true insight for SMRs, though, seems to be how their passive systems challenge the very idea of how those layers function, demanding regulators rethink safety from the ground up. Can you walk us through those five levels of defense in depth and then explain that challenge?
Absolutely. The five levels are sort of a hierarchy of protection. Level one is prevention. This is about building in quality from the start. Sound and conservative plant design, robust operation, ample safety margins, careful siting, and preventing any deviations from normal operation.
Stop problems before they start.
That's the goal. Level two is control of deviations. If something does go a bit off kilter, this level involves detecting those deviations and controlling them using specific safety systems and operational procedures to bring the plant back to a stable state.
Catching small issues early.
Right. Level three is accident mitigation. If an accident develops despite levels one and two, this level aims to prevent damage to the reactor core or significant offsite releases. This relies on inherent and engineered safety features and procedures.
The core safety system's kicking in.
Yes. Level four is severe accident mitigation.
Yeah.
Should a severe accident occur, the objective here is to mitigate its consequences, ensuring confinement functions are successful and radioactive releases are kept as low as reasonably achievable.
Containing the worst-case scenario.
Containing and mitigating, yes. And finally, level five is off-site emergency response. This is the final safety net, covered in the unexpected. It involves effective emergency arrangements and responses, including off-site measures, to protect the public and environment.
Planning for the unthinkable, essentially.
You have to. Now, to your point about the challenge for SMRs, SMRs extensively use passive features, such as natural circulation and gravity-driven injection, and inherent safety characteristics like increased core stability and smaller radionuclide inventory.
The things we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Designers often propose that these features reduce the need for stringent provisions at DD levels 3 and 4, suggesting the risk is inherently lower.
Because the reactor might take care of itself more.
That's the argument. But the core challenge for regulators is demonstrating the effectiveness and reliability of these passive systems, especially in complex scenarios or over the facility's long lifetime, given the lack of operating experience.
Right. Proving it works reliably without decades of data. I can imagine proving something is truly inherently safe without real-world data is a high bar.
It's a very high bar.
What about multi-module facilities where you have several SMRs side by side? Does that introduce new complexities for DITA?
It absolutely does. The concept of multiple SMR modules in close proximity introduces questions about shared systems.
Like shared cooling or controls?
Potentially, yes. And potential common cause failures impacting several DD levels simultaneously across different modules. A fire or flood, for instance.
One event takes out multiple defenses across multiple reactors.
That's the concern. The working group recommends developing specific principles for multi-module safety assessments to address these interdependencies.
Makes sense.
Another critical aspect of DD is the independence of its levels as far as practicable. For SMRs, especially with their compact designs, ensuring this independence can be challenging. A failure in one highly integrated system might inadvertently compromise multiple layers of defense.
Less physical separation, potentially more interaction between safety layers.
Could be, yeah. It needs careful analysis.
So how are regulators addressing these uncertainties to ensure that DD remains robust for SMRs? What's the bottom line here?
To address these uncertainties, regulators demand rigorous demonstration. All inherent safety characteristics credited in the safety case must be duly substantiated by SMR designers, with clear requirements and criteria defined beforehand.
Show us the proof.
Always. There's a specific need for further guidance and requirements for safety assessment of DD levels 1 and 2, and for demonstrating the reliability of passive systems over the facility's lifetime.
Filling the gaps in knowledge.
Exactly. Given the lack of operating experience with these novel systems, probabilistic safety assessments or PSAs become crucial tools to check the application of DD and identify potentially complex scenarios that might otherwise be missed.
Using models to explore the what-ifs.
In a very systematic way, yes.
That brings us to a huge, often contentious issue, emergency planning zones or EPZs.
Ah, yes, the EPZ debate.
With SMRs being smaller and potentially safer, there's been a lot of talk about reducing these zones. What's the traditional concept of an EPZ and how are SMRs challenging that?
Traditionally, an EPZ defines the area where operational and protective actions might be needed during a nuclear emergency. It's located outside the licensee's exclusion zone, the plant boundary, basically, and managed by external authorities.
Public evacuation zones, essentially.
That's a key part of it, yes. For traditional large nuclear plants, these zones often have fixed distances, sometimes for many miles.
Right, quite large areas.
Now, based on claims of smaller radionuclide inventories, meaning less radioactive material and inherent passive safety features, some SMR vendors are proposing significantly smaller EPZs.
How small are we talking?
Some proposals go as far as claiming they can be virtually eliminated, maybe just confined to the site boundary itself.
Wow, that's a massive reduction. It sounds appealing, a smaller reactor, a smaller safety footprint.
It does sound appealing.
But how are regulators approaching this proposal? Are they just accepting these claims at face value? Okay, tiny EPZ it is.
Not at all. The SMR Regulators Forum agrees that EPZ size can be scaled, but it must be based on solid, verifiable evidence.
Evidence-based scaling.
Exactly. Based on the specific technology, novel features, detailed design characteristics, and critically, site-specific considerations. The local environment matters.
Right. You can't just rubber stamp it.
Absolutely not. The existing IAEA safety requirements and methodology are generally considered effective for establishing EPZs and are being applied to SMRs with these new considerations in mind. It's about a highly tailored, evidence-based approach, not a blanket reduction.
So it's not a blanket reduction, but a highly tailored, evidence-based approach. What are the key factors that go into determining an EPZ for an SMR then? What should we as listeners really understand about this process?
Several critical factors must be considered. First, site evaluation is crucial. You need to identify factors beyond just the plant design that could affect safety and emergency planning.
Like local population density, roads.
Exactly. Local infrastructure, demographics, meteorology. Next is the evaluation of postulated initiating events, PIEs, the things that could start an accident sequence leading to radioactive releases.
What could go wrong, basically?
Yes. For novel SMRs, this might involve mechanistic methods for determining the source term, essentially, using detailed scientific models of how specific accidents would unfold to precisely predict what radioactive material might be released and how much.
A more precise prediction of the potential release.
That's the aim. Designers must also provide robust justification for any accident sequences deemed practically eliminated, as we discussed earlier. You can't just say it won't happen. You have to prove it to a very high degree of confidence.
Prove the elimination claim. Got it. And what about those multi-module sites we discussed earlier, where you have several SMRs grouped together? Does that complicate the EPZ calculation?
Absolutely. For multi-module sites, the potential for simultaneous failure of multiple units due to external hazards needs careful consideration, as it can profoundly affect EPZ methodology.
Because the source term could be larger or more complex.
Precisely. You can't just assume one reactor fails in isolation. Another unique aspect is off-site fuel handling.
Right, the transportable aspect.
For SMRs without on-site refueling, EPZs might be needed at intermediate stops or land-based maintenance facilities, specifically for fuel handling and storage during transport. This opens up entirely new logistical safety considerations.
Safety zones needed along the transport route.
Potentially, or at dedicated handling facilities, yes. Importantly, even with potentially reduced EPZs, some level of community emergency preparedness like public information and response drills is still required.
You still need a plan.
You always need a plan, especially if SMRs are sited in close proximity to densely populated centers. And finally, policy factors, including the public and political policies of host states, also influence EPZ determination alongside purely technical factors.
So politics and public acceptance play a role too.
They inevitably do. It's a complex, multifaceted decision, balancing technical realities with societal expectations.
That's a comprehensive look at the foundational regulatory principles. Now, let's zoom in on some specific novel design challenges that SMRs bring to the table, starting with containment systems.
Okay, containment, critical barrier.
When we think of nuclear power, we often visualize those massive dome-shaped concrete containment buildings. How are SMRs redefining that traditional barrier?
Yeah, the big dome is iconic.
Does that mean we're ditching the big concrete dome for something that's more like a really fancy layered Tupperware container for radioactive material?
That's a great way to put it, and in some cases, not far from the truth in terms of concept. For large light water reactors, or LWRs, containment typically refers to that single pressure-proof, leak-tight building.
Right, the final barrier.
But some advanced non-LWR SMRs are proposing something radically different. They claim that a single leak-tight containment structure is not relied upon in the same way.
Not relied upon? How does that work?
Instead, they aim to limit radionuclide releases through retention at the source, perhaps deep within the fuel itself, like with those TriZo fuels we mentioned.
Ah, the fuel as containment.
Partly, yes.
Yeah.
Or via multiple internal and external barriers that collectively perform the containment function. This has led to the concept of functional containment.
Functional containment, okay.
Which is essentially a set of barriers working together to limit radionuclide transport rather than one single massive structure doing all the heavy lifting.
So it's a more distributed, almost philosophical approach to containment. That sounds like it requires a very different regulatory mindset.
It absolutely does.
What are the key design principles that regulators are applying to these novel containment systems? How do they ensure this functional containment actually functions?
The principles are still anchored in fundamental safety, but adapted to the new designs. Firstly, the defense-in-depth DD approach is paramount. Containment designs must incorporate measures at each DD level, ensuring independence as far as practicable, still layers of protection.
The D remains central.
Always. Secondly, a graded approach is used, meaning assessments of these novel containment systems may be tailored, but a comprehensive safety case always needs to be presented to demonstrate safety. No shortcuts on the safety case.
Got it.
Designs must also account for extreme conditions, including internal and external hazards like fire, flood, seismic events, and human-induced events, and accommodate conditions like high pressure, temperature, radiation, and combustible gases within the containment.
Prepare for the worst.
Essentially, yes. It's about building resilience into every layer of that functional containment.
That covers immediate risks. But what about the longer-term performance of these novel containment designs? How do you know they'll hold up for decades? These plants run for a long time.
That's a critical consideration. With novel SMR designs, there's concern about potentially different or more rapid containment system degradation. Materials behave differently under different conditions.
New materials, new aging issues.
Potentially. This requires robust aging management and monitoring throughout the required lifetime. For things like submerged or underground containments, it might necessitate novel inspection techniques. Imagine trying to inspect a reactor vessel underwater or buried underground.
Tricky inspections.
Very. Leakage rates are also crucial. Any assumed leakage rates must be justified and demonstrated. And if a design claims no specific leakage rate is needed for the containment structure because of other barriers.
Like the fuel holding everything in.
For example. Then that requires exceptionally detailed justification. You have to prove the other barriers are sufficient. Finally, designs must provide for the control and cleanup of fission products, hydrogen, oxygen, and other substances from the containment atmosphere to prevent uncontrolled releases or explosions.
Managing the internal environment.
Crucial.
And for multi-module SMRs, especially if sited underground or submerged, how does that impact the containment design? Does a problem in one module suddenly affect all of them from a containment perspective?
Exactly. That's a key question. For multi-module SMRs, particularly if sited underground or submerged, specific hazards introduced by these arrangements must be considered in containment design.
Like shared foundations or atmospheres?
Could be. Regulators need to analyze challenges related to shared features and dependencies between modules or units to ensure that the integrity of defense in depth is not detrimentally impacted. The last thing you want is a common failure compromising the containment across an entire site of multiple reactors.
Right, a cascading failure. Okay, let's unpack this further because SMR's reliance on passive and inherent safety is often touted as one of their biggest advantages.
It's a major selling point.
But it sounds like it's also a double-edged sword for regulators. What's the big promise here and what are the corresponding challenges that keep regulators up at night?
The promise is indeed significant, almost revolutionary. SMRs extensively leverage passive and inherent safety features for accident prevention and mitigation.
Remind us what those are again.
Things like increased core stability, smaller radionuclide inventories, and passive cooling mechanisms like natural circulation and gravity-driven injection, which don't rely on external power or active components like pumps.
Physics doing the safety work.
That's the idea. Many also boast integral designs for simplification and unique fuel designs, such as ceramic TriZo materials, that claim to offer the practical elimination of some severe accidents. The idea is to make safety intrinsic to the physics and design, rather than relying solely on active complex safety systems.
Okay, when I hear inherently safer, my skeptic antenna goes up. What's the hidden downside or the trickier part that regulators have to wrestle with when designers make those kinds of claims?
You're hitting on the core of the regulatory challenge. While the promise is high, the scrutiny for regulators is equally significant. Firstly, Demonstration and substantiation are paramount. Always prove it. Regulators require rigorous substantiation of all credited inherent safety characteristics and passive features. This means extensive R&D, experimental prototypical systems, integrated test facilities, and validated computer models.
The works.
Especially for FORK facilities, where uncertainties are inherently high due to a lack of operating experience. They want to see the proof, not just the claim.
It makes sense that they'd want to see the proof. Mm. What about the reliability of these passive systems? How do you assess something that doesn't have moving parts in the traditional sense? How do you know it will always work?
That's precisely a major challenge. Reliability assessment. Characterizing the reliability of passive systems, particularly those with weak driving forces like natural circulation or gravity, is inherently difficult.
Weak forces, okay.
Designers must define clear criteria for these forces, understand all potential failure modes like potential blockages over decades of operation.
Like a pipe getting clogged.
Something like that, or material degradation affecting flow. They need to ensure reliability over the facility's lifetime, considering phenomena like aging or clogging. The forum notes that quantitative reliability expectations for passive systems still lack a universally accepted methodology.
So, no standard way to measure passive reliability yet.
Not a universally agreed one, which makes regulatory assessment complex. While passive components may sometimes be exempted from the single failure criterion.
Meaning you don't assume one randomly fails.
Right. But this requires strong justification, such as extremely high quality in design and manufacturing, robust inspection, and assurance that they are unaffected by the postulated initiating event that requires them to function.
Very high confidence needed for that exemption.
Extremely high.
And how do these passive systems interact with the risk of common cause failures? You'd think fewer active parts might mean fewer ways for things to go wrong, but I'm sensing a but.
You're right, there's a but. While passive systems aim to reduce complex logic and failure possibilities, they can also introduce more subtle failure modes or increase susceptibility to common cause multi-module events.
How so?
For instance, an internal fire or flood could simultaneously impact the path of cooling mechanisms across all modules on a site if they rely on the same ambient conditions or shared structures.
Ah, so shared vulnerability.
Potentially.
Yeah.
This necessitates careful consideration of common cause failures, CCF, and diversity in safety systems remains crucial to mitigate these. You might still want different types of safety systems.
Don't put all your safety eggs in one passive basket.
Essentially, yes. The forum suggests that any combination of active and passive safety systems is acceptable, provided DDE and safety design principles are met. However, there may be benefit in using combinations for diversification, especially given the current uncertainties in passive system reliability.
Hedging your bets with a mix of active and passive.
It could be a prudent approach.
It's clear that SMRs present a paradox of simplification and new complexities. And that complexity is amplified when we talk about multi-module facilities.
Definitely.
What exactly do we mean by modular in this context? And why does having multiple units pose such a unique regulatory challenge? Is the terminology even consistent?
This raises an important question right from the start. The term modular itself can be ambiguous. It can refer to modular design approaches, meaning standardized components.
Like using the same pump design everywhere.
Yes. Or it can mean modular construction approaches involving factory fabrication and transport.
Building blocks made in a factory.
Right. And the terms module and unit also lack a unified meaning, sometimes referring to a core with its own confinement or several cores within a single plant that may or may not be autonomous.
So what one company calls a module, another might call a unit or part of a unit.
Exactly. This terminological imprecision already creates regulatory hurdles because you need to know exactly what you're regulating.
So even defining the basic building blocks can be difficult. What are the practical implications when you have multiple potentially interconnected modules on one site?
A key characteristic of multi-module SMRs is the potential for sharing systems, structures, and components, SSCs.
Sharing infrastructure.
Yes. This could include shared containment, control rooms, electrical systems, compressed air systems, heat sinks, or even shared personnel like maintenance or emergency response teams.
Okay, sharing makes economic sense.
It offers potential economic efficiencies, yes, but it introduces significant interdependencies and hazards.
Sharing systems to save costs seems logical, but I can see how that could become a safety concern quickly if one shared system fails.
Indeed. Shared SSCs can introduce risk-significant vulnerabilities if their failure impacts all modules simultaneously. Think about a shared cooling water intake getting blocked.
Yeah, that affects everyone.
Or external hazards, or even internal events like a fire or flood could cause common mode failures, impacting several defense and depth levels across multiple modules. This requires designs to explicitly account for the potential for simultaneous impacts on all units.
Designing for site-wide events, not just single-unit events.
Absolutely. Beyond equipment, there are also significant operational impacts. Construction or maintenance activities on one module could pose hazards to adjacent operating units.
Like dropping something heavy next door.
Or creating dust, vibrations, disrupting shared services.
Yeah.
An accident at one unit could affect the accident progression or hamper accident management activities at a neighboring unit.
Making it harder to respond.
Yes. And of course, available resources, personnel, equipment would need to be carefully shared and managed across the entire facility, especially during an emergency.
Enough people, enough beer for multiple simultaneous problems.
That needs careful planning and justification.
So it's not just about one reactor safety, but the safety of the entire complex. How does this demand a different approach to risk assessment?
This necessitates regulators and designers moving beyond the single unit mindset and considering whole site risk.
Looking at the big picture.
Exactly. This involves aggregating risks from differing on-site sources, including new and old reactors if it's an existing site, spent fuel pools, and addressing the increased accident complexity due to intermodule interactions.
More complex interactions, more complex risk.
Right. Probabilistic safety assessments need to be enhanced to account for multi-unit common cause failures and causal dependencies, potentially new accident end states, and the timing of releases from different units.
Mm-hmm.
It's a far more intricate picture of risk than evaluating a single independent large reactor.
That's a lot to consider in terms of design and safety principles. Now let's play out the actual drama. How does one of these novel designs actually get the green light?
The licensing phase, yes.
This sounds like a journey fraught with unique checkpoints and debates. Are regulators throwing out the old rule books, or are they adapting existing ones for SMRs?
What's fascinating here is that, for the most part, the fundamental principles of nuclear licensing, the submission of an application, a sufficiency review, detailed technical assessment, and licensing basis development, still apply to SMRs.
The basic steps are the same.
Yes. The process continues to focus on the applicant's proposal to conduct activities safely and demonstrate compliance with the regulatory framework. So it's not about entirely new processes, but rather adapting existing ones. They're retrofitting the system, if you will.
That makes sense. You wouldn't want to reinvent the wheel completely if the core safety goals are the same.
Precisely.
But are there efficiencies to be gained, especially if SMRs are meant for mass production and deployment? Can the process be streamlined?
Absolutely. While entirely new licensing processes aren't always necessary, significant efficiencies can be gained in existing ones, particularly for nth of a kind or NOAIC plants.
NOAIC, the ones built after the first one.
Right. These are subsequent deployments that can leverage operating experience and lessons learned from prior deployments. The review can be faster if the design hasn't changed much.
Learn from the first, speed up the rest.
That's the idea. Design certification is also an acceptable approach to streamline licensing for standardized designs.
Certifying the design itself separate from a specific site.
Yes. This is particularly useful for countries planning to build many copies on multiple sites, as it pre-approves the core design, reduces repetitive reviews.
Makes sense for standardization.
However, the forum emphasizes that design certification is a national decision and not a prerequisite for an efficient process. Some countries might prefer site-specific licensing for everything.
Okay, so it sounds like a flexible, adaptable process. But you mentioned FOAIC, or first-of-a-kind, plants earlier.
Yes, the prototypes.
What are the specific challenges of licensing a FOAIC SMR compared to a NO1? Is it like the difference between getting a prototype car approved versus a mass-produced model?
It's a very apt comparison. Every new SMR design starts as a FOCO, meaning it introduces innovative but often unproven technologies.
New tech, new questions.
Exactly. This brings a unique set of challenges. Firstly, there are increased uncertainties. Less complete information and greater technical unknowns require additional regulatory effort and often additional demonstration requirements from the applicant. More homework for the vendor.
More proof needed.
And regulators expect FOAIC designs to employ additional features or increase safety margins to mitigate these unknowns.
Building in extra caution.
Yes, things like supplementary safety systems or more conservative operational approaches, just in case.
So a FOAIC plant might need to be over-engineered, in a sense, to account for those unknowns.
You could say that. There's a strong emphasis on extensive R&D and testing, including performance tests and integral testing, to build credibility, validate computer codes, and robustly support the safety case. This is crucial before widespread deployment.
Testing, testing, testing.
Absolutely. And during early operations, specific controls, like very careful startup control, extensive commissioning tests, and enhanced monitoring, are implemented to gather essential operational experience, or OPEX.
Watching it very closely at the beginning.
Exactly. That OPEX is vital to inform future designs and subsequent licensing.
And as that OPEX builds, how does a FOAK transition into a NOAK, and what does that mean for subsequent licensing? Does it become significantly easier?
As SMR deployments evolve from OAK to NOAK, the lessons learned and OPEX from the initial plants inform and streamline the licensing of subsequent NOAKs, leading to efficiencies in technical assessment.
So yes, it should get easier or faster.
Generally, yes. Mm-hmm. However, regulators must carefully consider how incremental design changes, module by module, can impact safety as the design evolves.
Tweaking the design along the way.
Right. You need to make sure those tweaks don't introduce new risks. Crucially, the forum insists that standards should not be lowered for FOAK deployments just because it's the first one. The safety bar remains high.
No cutting corners on the first one.
Absolutely not. And the regulatory framework needs to remain stable, even as designs evolve. Predictability matters.
That makes perfect sense. Given the long life cycle of these facilities, from factory to decommissioning, I imagine there are specific points where regulators want to pay extra close attention.
Definitely.
What are these key regulatory interventions or CARIs that are unique to the SMR life cycle? Where do regulators really put their foot down?
Key regulatory interventions, or KRIs, are strategic points of interest, basically regulatory hold points, where regulators may impose higher scrutiny or require explicit authorization to proceed. They focus on areas of higher safety risk.
Okay, specific milestones.
For SMRs, their modularity and novel deployment models introduce some unique KRIs across their entire life cycle. For example, during factory manufacturing.
Before it even gets to the site.
Yes. Inspections and approvals of modules manufactured offsite become critical, potentially even before the ultimate licensee, the utility, is fully involved. New guidance for factory inspections may be needed. Regulating the supply chain.
So regulating parts of the reactor before they even arrive on site. That's a shift in focus from traditional construction.
It is.
What about after manufacturing, during transport and setup? More KRIs there.
Indeed. Offsite commissioning, where modules are tested before leaving the factory, after assembly, or maybe even fuel loading, requires robust documentation and verification. A KRI point there.
Testing before shipping.
Then there's transportation itself. Licensing, capability verification, and configuration management for transporting fueled modules involve significant safety, security, and legal challenges that demand specific KRIs. That's a big one.
Moving fueled reactors around, yeah, that needs oversight.
Big time. Once on-site construction and installation activities, such as pouring first concrete, modifications, and especially adding new modules adjacent to operating ones, pose additional hazards requiring advanced consideration and regulatory oversight. Another KRI.
Building next to a running reactor.
Precisely. Yeah. Very sensitive operation.
And the operation and eventual decommissioning must have their own unique checkpoints, too.
Yes. On-site commissioning includes post-transport acceptance testing and pre-post installation commissioning for individual modules, KRIs there.
Making sure it arrived okay and works as installed.
Right. During operation, KRIs include first criticality, power ascension, those early operations controls we mentioned, and major component replacements, especially with novel operating concepts like remote control, shared control rooms, or different companies handling maintenance.
Lots of checks during operation, too.
And finally, decommissioning plans must be credible for novel technologies. And sequence decommissioning, where some modules operate while others are decommissioned on the same site, raises specific safety and security concerns requiring careful regulatory attention. That's another potential KRI.
Operating next to a demolition site, essentially.
A very radioactive one, potentially. So, yes, needs careful management.
So a lot of new ground to cover. And who is ultimately responsible for ensuring all these complex activities are performed safely? We have vendors, manufacturers, transporters, operators.
A complex web.
What about the organizations and their capabilities in this evolving SMR landscape? Who holds the buck?
This raises an important question. Who holds the ultimate accountability? The forum maintains that the licensee is ultimately responsible and accountable for the safe conduct of licensed activities.
The operator, usually the utility.
Typically, yes. Even if they delegate activities to vendors or contractors, the licensee holds the responsibility. They must possess the capability and resources to oversee the entire supply chain and thoroughly understand the design, procurement, and quality assurance processes. This can't be outsourced.
The licensee needs to be an intelligent customer.
Very much so.
But with SMRs attracting new innovators, aren't we seeing new players in the nuclear market who might not have that deep nuclear experience? Does that place an additional burden on regulators?
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
The SMR market attracts new vendors and potentially new licensees who may indeed lack mature nuclear experience or established safety culture.
Startups entering the nuclear space.
Could be. This places an increased burden on regulators to verify capabilities and necessitates targeted training programs for both regulators and the new players, building capacity on both sides.
Right.
Because of this, and the very limited operational experience available for SMRs, benchmarking against existing practices or international standards becomes a crucial tool for assessing the capabilities of SMR vendors and licensees.
Comparing them to established players or standards.
It's about ensuring competence, even when direct experience is scarce.
All these national regulatory efforts are vital, but SMRs are a global market. How much global alignment or harmonization is truly possible or desirable when each country has its own legal framework and priorities?
That's the big question.
Is a single global SMR rule book ever going to happen?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, each member state retains the fundamental responsibility to establish its national regulatory framework. That's sovereign territory.
National laws come first.
Exactly. This inevitably leads to inherent differences between national frameworks, influenced by legal context, how they interpret the IAEA safety framework, and stakeholder inputs. Therefore, the forum concludes that harmonization of most requirements and guidance globally will remain a significant long-term and complex challenge.
So, probably not happening soon.
That's not a simple task. Don't expect a single global SMR rulebook anytime soon. The differences are often deeply embedded in national legal and political systems.
So no one-size-fits-all solution for now, but are there any areas where agreement can be found or where regulators can at least learn from each other to avoid reinventing the wheel everywhere?
Despite the overarching challenges, there are specific areas where harmonization or agreement can be achieved, drawing lessons from existing cooperative approaches, like the Multinational Design Evaluation Program, MDEP, for large reactors.
Okay, cooperation is possible.
Yes. For instance, sharing best practices in areas like safety analysis methodologies or approaches to passive system reliability is highly beneficial. Collaborating on research for novel technologies.
Learning from each other's reviews.
Exactly. However, decisions on adopting design certification regimes or specific licensing processes remain firmly national decisions, balancing global best practices with unique national contexts and priorities. It's about collaboration and mutual learning, not necessarily complete convergence.
We've covered a tremendous amount, from the reactors themselves to their regulation and licensing. Now let's talk about something that traditionally has been viewed in separate silos: safety, security, and safeguards.
The three S's, yes.
Why is there now such a strong push for an integrated 3S approach for SMRs? What's driving this change away from the siloed approach?
What's fascinating here is that traditionally, nuclear safety, security, and safeguards, which deals with tracking nuclear material to prevent diversion, have often been considered as separate disciplines.
Yeah.
Each with its own requirements, experts, and processes.
Different teams, different rules.
Often, yes. However, SMRs, with their distinct characteristics, their compactness, modularity, potential for remote operation, and novel fuels, necessitate a reevaluation and a more integrated 3S approach.
Why do SMR features demand this integration more?
Because the inherent design features of SMRs mean that a decision made for safety could have significant implications for security, and vice versa, in ways that may not have been as pronounced in larger, more conventional plants with more physical separation.
Tighter integration means the disciplines interact more.
Exactly. You can't just design for safety and then slap security measures on after the fact anymore. The design choices are intertwined from the start.
So it's about breaking down those traditional silos to avoid unforeseen conflicts and, I imagine, save some headaches later.
That's a big part of it.
What are the benefits of this integration, and what exactly does it mean to look for synergies and conflicts?
The primary benefits are efficiency and cost savings. By integrating 3S considerations from the early design stages, the aim is to decrease resource demand, reduce inefficiencies, and critically avoid costly retrofits.
Fixing problems later is always expensive.
always. Retrofits were often required in traditional nuclear plants when security or safeguards measures were added later in the design or construction process. Integration also involves proactively identifying both synergies, where complementary design approaches optimize all three disciplines.
Like a feature that helps safety and security.
Precisely. And identifying potential conflicts, where a measure for one discipline might inadvertently adversely affect another.
Like a safety feature making security harder.
Could be. Identifying these early allows designers to mitigate conflicts and leverage synergies directly into the design. It's about optimization.
That makes perfect sense. So let's explore these key interfaces. How do safety and security considerations interact for SMRs? Where's the overlap?
There are several critical interfaces between safety and security. For instance, claims that passive safety measures automatically reduce security risks must be thoroughly justified through rigorous security risk assessments.
You can't just assume safer means more secure.
No, you need to analyze it. A system designed to fail-safe might, in some scenarios, be easier to disable maliciously if not carefully considered. Secondly, safety analysis can inform security.
Huh?
Insights from safety assessments, such as probabilistic safety assessments, PSAs, are invaluable for identifying potential sabotage targets, vital areas within the plant, and assessing vulnerabilities to malevolent acts. This allows security measures to be strategically placed where they matter most.
Using safety studies to find security weak spots.
Exactly. It helps prioritize security efforts.
And what about the day-to-day operations and emergency responses? This sounds like a tightrope walk between being open for safety crews and closed for security.
You're absolutely right. When developing operating principles and procedures, licensees must account for both safety and security risks. Changes to procedures need evaluation for impact on both.
Can't change a safety rule without thinking security.
Or vice versa. Emergency preparedness is another area of strong interface, where safety and security emergency response plans should be coordinated. A common potential conflict here is balancing facilitated access for emergency teams during a safety event.
Getting firefighters in quickly.
With the controlled access required for security purposes, like keeping unauthorized people out. This needs careful planning to ensure both objectives can be met without hindrance during a crisis.
Pre-planning those access protocols is key.
Crucial.
Okay, that covers safety and security. Now let's turn to the interface between safety and safeguards, which often deals with preventing nuclear material from being diverted for weapons or other illicit uses.
Right, the non-proliferation aspect. For safety and safeguards, several interfaces are key. First, IAEA safeguards, equipment cameras, seals, sensors used by international inspectors should be designed so that its failure does not impact plant safety.
Safeguards gear shouldn't cause a safety problem.
That's a fundamental design criterion. Also, the physical layout of compact or complex SMR designs may make certain areas inaccessible to IAEA personnel during operation due to safety concerns like high radiation.
So inspectors can't get everywhere?
Potentially not during operation. This requires alternative means for safeguards verification, like remote monitoring or designing access points carefully. Given the potential for increased fuel enrichment in some SMRs compared to existing nuclear power plants.
Higher enrichment is a proliferation concern.
It is. So criticality control and design is paramount, ensuring configurations of nuclear material storage and movement are safe and accommodate IAEA verification needs.
So highly enriched fuel means more scrutiny from both safety and safeguards perspectives.
Definitely.
What about accidental events and how safeguards ties into them?
If a design features in-vessel retention, IVR, of core melt under severe accidents.
Keeping melted fuel inside the reactor vessel?
Yes. This benefits both safety by containing fission products and safeguards by retaining fissile material within a known contained location. That's a clear Synergy 1 design feature serving two critical 3S goals.
Nice when that happens.
Conversely, if fissile material needs to be drained, for example, in some molten salt reactor designs, the design must accommodate IAEA verification requirements for that drained material. The design should also aim to allow the IAEA to maintain its safeguard systems even during off-normal events or transients.
Keeping track of material even when things go wrong.
That's the goal.
And finally, how do security and safeguards interact? Where are the overlaps and potential friction points there? They both involve protecting nuclear material.
They do, but often with different focuses. For security and safeguards, the Nuclear Material Accounting and Control, NMAC system, the plant's internal system for tracking materials should be designed to meet both legal safeguards obligations and nuclear security objectives, leveraging synergies between them.
One tracking system serving two masters.
Ideally, yes. Access controls and the physical layout must also balance security needs, keeping bad actors out, with IAEA safeguards verification requirements, letting inspectors in where needed.
Another access balancing act.
Always. For instance, remote data transmission for safeguards purposes, which may be common in SMRs to reduce inspector presence, should not compromise cybersecurity and must meet IAEA standards for data integrity and confidentiality.
Protecting the safeguards data stream.
Crucial. Lastly, surveillance systems cameras for domestic security and cameras for IAEA safeguards must be designed so they do not interfere with each other, physically or electronically. It's all about a cohesive system where elements don't undermine each other.
That's a truly integrated view. It sounds complex to achieve in practice. So how are designers and regulators actually implementing this vision of 3S integration? What methodologies are being developed to make this a reality?
The forum has identified several methodologies to facilitate this integration. A key one is the systems engineering process.
Systems engineering.
Yes. This provides a structured approach from early concept design through to detailed design and construction. It systematically identifies and resolves those 3S conflicts we discussed, while also leveraging potential synergies between safety, security, and safeguards.
Building 3S in from the start.
Exactly. It's about comprehensive upfront planning, building it in from the ground up rather than bolting it on later.
And how does the physical layout of the plant contribute to this integrated thinking? You mentioned compactness earlier.
The design of structures and plant layout is another critical area. Structural designs can offer simultaneous protection for safety against internal and external hazards, for security against threats, and for safeguards against unauthorized removal. Think hardened structures.
One concrete wall helps all three.
Potentially, yes. A compact plant layout, while potentially advantageous for security response times, could also reduce barriers for adversaries or impact the space available for necessary 3S systems, structures, and components. So this requires careful consideration to optimize the balance.
Trade-offs again.
Always trade-offs.
And how do you make decisions when you're dealing with so much new technology and potentially limited data, especially for security threats or rare events?
That's where risk-informed and performance-based integrated decision-making, RAPBDM, comes in. While data limitations exist for novel SMRs, this approach aims to make balanced decisions based on available risk information and desired performance outcomes for all three S's.
Making the best call with the info you have.
Essentially. Tools like the Bowtie approach, a risk management tool, help by examining lines of protection for prevention, control, or mitigation of risks, visualizing how different measures contribute to 3S objectives. It helps design in 3S considerations early.
Visualizing the defenses.
And another methodology is the Objective Provision Tree, OPT, which is a hierarchical structure used to analyze safety and security risks by mapping challenges, mechanisms, safety functions, and the provisions designed to address them. These methodologies all aim to bring a structured, proactive, and integrated approach to 3S for SMRs. What's fascinating here is how SMRs are not just a technological shift, but really a catalyst for regulators to rethink fundamental safety philosophies.
Pushing the boundaries of regulation itself.
Absolutely. The level of detail and foresight in these reports, like the SMR Regulators Forum Phase 2 and Phase 3 reports, really shows the global community working to proactively address complex challenges.
Getting ahead of the curve.
Trying to, yes. From how we define a safe distance around a reactor, the EPZ, to integrating security and safeguards right into the initial design, it's about building confidence, not just in technology, but in the entire ecosystem that ensures its safe operation.
The whole package.
You know, when I first started in nuclear safety, the idea of an integrated 3S approach was almost heresy. You kept safety, security, and safeguards in their own very distinct boxes.
Right, separate worlds.
The fact that SMRs are forcing us to blend them is a testament to how profoundly these designs are shaking up our foundational thinking. It's quite remarkable, actually.
Absolutely. We've taken a deep dive today into the nuances of graded approaches, the multi-layered defense in depth, and the reevaluation of emergency planning zones.
Covered a lot of ground.
All while keeping SMR's unique modularity and passive safety features in focus. It's clear that the journey from a first-of-a-kind SMR to widespread deployment requires incredible collaboration, research, and a willingness to adapt our frameworks.
Constant learning and adaptation.
So what does this all mean for you, our listener? It means that as SMRs potentially reshape our energy landscape, the foundations of safety are being rigorously scrutinized and innovatively reimagined.
A lot of work is going on behind the scenes.
Which leads to an important question, I think. How do you think public perception and acceptance of SMRs will evolve as these intricate regulatory complexities are navigated and translated into real-world applications? Will smaller EPZs build trust or raise new questions?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
And thinking about this deep dive, what aspects of this intricate regulatory dance would you want to explore next? What questions remain for you?